this is an international treaty. Countries, states, parties sign the treaty, and one of the things they commit to is to look after and protect and conserve World Heritage Sites on their own territory. How do you think, I guess this is the post-inscription question, how do you think states' parties do in that regard?
Some do well, some do much less well. I think overall I'm disappointed in the number of countries that lose interest, at least as soon as they have sites on the convention. The state party should immediately, after inscription, ask itself what it's going to do to enhance the conditions for survival, for protection within those sites. I mean, those conditions should be adequate, because that's one of the questions that's asked. Is this site well managed? Is this site already protected? And if the site is not protected or well managed, it shouldn't be on the list in the first place. So there should be a standard already in place. But I think they should ask, what more can we do? And the kind of answers to that question that mean something are, and you can see this in some countries. Some countries invent, they say, there's nothing in our legislation that even mentions World Heritage. So maybe we have to re-rig our national legislation to have a chapter that says World Heritage is here, and what support do we offer for World Heritage? Some governments also set up, from a management perspective, a World Heritage Working Group, inside the service involved with cultural heritage, to give a focus, to the 3 or 4 or 10 sites that they may have on the World Heritage List, to put those people together in a network as well, but to also to give some clout to decision making, because if it's 10 sites and they're working together inside the management framework of the country, then they have some priority when it comes to choices about where the money goes and choices about how development takes place. So I think there's a whole range of measures that countries could pick up if they wished immediately afterwards.
What would you cite as best practice in terms of that kind of structuring or putting in place the down the road, post-inscription measures?
Well, one of the things, and is, this is, I've seen this done in a few places, and it's worked quite well. One of the things, we were often asking governments as they prepare their nominations, or before, or sometimes even after, to put in place what we call a management plan. We use different words for this and refer to it in different ways, and it's misunderstood sometimes and understood in other ways, different ways by those involved. But we're basically asking for a formalized plan, a management plan, which would give priority to heritage in relation to other legitimate objectives of development, for a place. It's very easy to do a plan. No, it's not very easy, but it's an exercise which professionals can figure out how to do. They can produce a document. They can involve those who are responsible for management in the document, so the document has legitimacy. But if it stays there inside the site without being attached to something larger, it may fail when there are real competing priorities. As soon as there's a management plan, it should be brought to the attention of cabinet as an overarching instrument. And quite a number of governments have done that. The integrated management plan in Kathmandu Valley, for the Kathmandu Valley, one of the reasons I like it is because it was brought to cabinet. Somebody had the wisdom to think, let's these guys figure it out, because in cabinet is the minister of every one of these, ventures. And so whether or not they like it, whether or not they buy into it immediately, if it becomes a cabinet document, then they're all bound to it. So it's, again, a way of raising the profile, raising the commitment to World Heritage in a simple way.
Another element of states' parties' engagement when they sign the World Heritage Convention is that they will do no harm to World Heritage sites anywhere in the world. What would be your assessment of the degree to which countries have respected that engagement?
I think they haven't respected that very much, but it's also very difficult for them for governments to think, how are they actually going to achieve that goal? I mean, everybody can sit around the table and say, yeah, of course, we're not going to do any harm. We're going to take positive steps with the sites we know, but we're also not going to harm anybody else's. But, the people that are going to do the harm are not necessarily sitting around that same table. I'll use Canada as an example, because Canada is a country that has mining ventures everywhere in the world. I did a mission, or two missions, sequentially for UNESCO in Mongolia about 2 summers ago. And the primary mission was to look at the management of the Orkhon Valley cultural landscape. This is the cultural landscape where Genghis Khan comes from. But as we moved through the site and looked at the complexity of the site and the different archaeological sites, the more recent monasteries, the nomadic lifestyle in the steppes, which comprise most of the cultural landscape. Eventually, we went up into the hilly part of the site, into some monasteries up at the higher levels. Anyway, at the top of the mountain, and the big reason we were led up there was to see the devastation being wrought by a Canadian mining company. And those people back in Canada, are not part of the heritage group. They're not part of this dialogue. They work in a completely different way. They're very elusive. And it's very difficult to say to them, by the way, Canada has a commitment. Canada has made a commitment. Do no harm. And you're Canadian and you're part of this. So from now on, please refrain. They're going to look at the person who says that as if they're out of their minds. Now, I don't know how many times I've sat in the World Heritage Committee and watched, the mining discussion. It happens often with natural heritage sites, but it happens equally with large cultural heritage sites. And it always seems those discussions in the committee go around for years and years and years in circles. And it seems impossible to nail the mining company down to any kind of dialogue. Sometimes, eventually you find a way to talk to them and they will back up, or they will rethink the way they're doing things and say, well, we could do it over here. We don't have to do it here. But it's a continuing very difficult problem, I think, for World Heritage.
Another aspect of the doing no harm, and in fact is beyond doing no harm, and that is sort of collective action to safeguard historic places or natural places, World Heritage Sites. And that really comes out of the roots of the origins of the creation of the convention. How well do you think countries are doing that kind of help to other World Heritage Sites in other countries?
There certainly are examples of, countries that adopt other countries, a kind of twinning, not from place to place, but country to country. I've seen that with Belgium, for example, in Europe, sort of thinking, well, maybe we owe something to some of the countries that we, in Africa, where we were once involved, and maybe we could, not as a way of paying for our sins, but just in the modern day, maybe we could try to take up some of the responsibilities they confront with less resources than we have, and share the process of developing nominations, share the process of developing management instruments that are appropriate for those conditions. I've seen that happen from, on a small number of occasions where that kind of collective action has brought a couple of countries together. But it hasn't happened very often. I think when you're easily defeated with lack of resources question, it's unfortunate because it doesn't always mean resources. It simply means sharing. It means developing the habit of sharing. And if you can develop that habit with X number of countries in the world, it's very positive. I think the recent tendency to see more, transboundary serial nominations come forward could work in this direction. It's a kind of complicated tendency with positives and negatives. Sometimes I think it's quite legitimate, where the countries themselves decide that they've found something in common that they want to work on together. And if they can overcome the obstacle of getting six different ministers of culture to sit in the room at the same time, so at least to give a chapeau to this venture so that it could proceed individually in a common framework, it can produce, I think, very good results. But and I think that's that habit, once encouraged, for the creation or the formation of a serial inscription can continue long after the serial inscription might be in place. It might become a kind of we work together on these things, so we'll continue to work together on other things once that habit is developed. So I think that's always there as a potential, but I think it's too little realized. And when it's realized, I think, a lot of the examples I've cited have been where there's been an effort to work together on something, be it nominations, be it conservation. Too often, when countries get together, it turns into a one-way flow of resources from the developed country to the developing country. And this can be the recolonization of those countries.